I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, today's guest is Rob Gay, and he's the education curator at the Idaho Museum of Natural History in Pocatello. We're talking today about using new technologies like 3D printing to learn about nature. Peter, this is a fun topic. This is obviously close to home for us. We're at the museum here, and 3D printing and 3D scanning is something we've been doing for quite a long time.
You guys are kind of known for this, and you've gone all over the world and helped with scanning and printing, haven't you?
We have indeed, and we've looked at some pretty famous fossils. We'll get into some of that, I think. Lots of time to discuss that with our guest today. But first, I bet you got some nature news.
You bet. So, Leif, over 2,000 Smilodon fatalis skulls have been excavated from the La Brea tar pits.
La Brea in downtown L.A.
In downtown L.A., and we were talking about the saber-tooth cat.
Yes.
Within these skulls, again, we're 2,000, a very small handful of these skulls have had sabers attached to them with an odd feature. That is, the socket has been occupied by two teeth.
What?
Yes, with the permanent saber tooth slotted into a groove in the baby tooth.
Wait a second. Okay, I think everybody can picture the saber-tooth cat classic. Yep. With the big canines that just kind of are freakishly long, sticking. Yep. Outside of the mouth.
Yep.
And you're saying there's another baby tooth next to it?
There's a baby tooth next to it, and the permanent tooth is kind of growing in a, there's a groove that baby tooth is kind of sitting in.
Okay.
And, of course, this has fascinated some paleontologists, and with limited numbers, it's kind of hard to really decide why that's the case. But we have paleontologist Jack Sen from UC Berkeley, and he has an idea as to why that baby tooth was present. And it's there to help stabilize the permanent tooth against sideways breakage as it erupts, as it grows. So when you think about it, as the tooth is growing, it becomes kind of more narrow.
Right.
And there's the strength, and you look at any canine, even with our modern day cats and their canines, they're significantly smaller, but they're really thick on the backside. So it strengthens that tooth so it doesn't break, you know, like when they bite down, it's not breaking out. But there's lateral tension as you bite as well, and that's pushing it from the side. And as that canine grows and becomes more narrow, it becomes weaker. And what he's saying, and he's used this theory called the beam theory, which engineers use, and it's basically a way of calculating the load carrying and deflection characteristic of beams, in which, in this case, he was using it on the lateral loads of a saber, of one of those teeth. And what he found is the teeth that had the sockets that had the two teeth in there with the baby tooth, that lateral load was significantly stiffer or stronger. And so they're hypothesizing there's less breakage because of that baby tooth. And then he's also saying that as the saber-tooth cat grows, he's hoping that they've learned how to hunt with these massive teeth. And by the time that baby tooth falls out, they are capable hunters, and they will damage or put their sabers at less risk of breaking.
Interesting. So these long teeth are, because of their length, are somewhat unstable because there's more leverage on them. And so a little baby tooth is, at least early in life for the animal, providing a little support structure to keep the teeth from bending sideways, right?
Yes.
Or breaking
and
off
breaking
sideways.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And we have a couple thousand of these skulls, which is amazing to think about, that are coming out of the middle of town in Los Angeles.
Right. It's just one area, and it's amazing. Yeah.
That's fantastic. There's so much we can still learn about these Ice Age critters, and it's fun to think that those animals were here also in Pocatello. We have fossils of them just outside of town, part of our history. It's great. Today's question, our trivia question, is dealing with our scanning lab. We have a scanning lab over at the museum called the Idaho Virtualization Lab. We'll talk a little bit more about. And our trivia question today is a little peculiar. It is, what is the coolest thing we have scanned at the IVL? That's an awfully subjective question. We will have some subjective answers to.
I have a feeling it will not be my daughter's head.
I think your answer might be that.
Right.
We'll explain when we come back from the break. Rob Gay joins us to talk about 3D printing and all the great things. Stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome today's guest. It's Rob Gay, and he is our education curator at the Idaho Museum of Natural History right here in Pocatello. So first off, thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Yeah, very glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I know about you, but why don't you tell our audience about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I run the education department here at the Idaho Museum of Natural History right here on the campus of ISU. And prior to moving up to Pocatello about 3 years ago to head up this program and do all the outreach all across Idaho, not just here in southeastern Idaho, I was in Colorado working for a public lands nonprofit there called Colorado Canyons Association. And prior to that, I was at the Museums of Western Colorado as their education curator. So I've been bouncing around the West doing a variety of education-related things. My formal training is in paleontology. So I also do a lot of research related to sort of the dawn of the dinosaurs type stuff from southeastern Utah, but I've been immersing myself in Idaho paleontology as well, and it's fascinating.
Absolutely. And, you know, one way that paleontologists are starting to, have over the last decade or so been understanding the fossil record is by using new computer-based technologies. And so we have a lab at the museum called the Idaho Virtualization Lab. Do you want to speak a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so the Idaho Virtualization Lab is a unit within the museum that is well known. Prior to me coming here to the Idaho Museum of Natural History, it was something that was part of my lexicon in Colorado when we talked about getting grants to go digitize specimens. And that's what the IVL does, is using a variety of technologies, laser scanners and photogrammetry, and even processing CT scan data, we're able to create digital models of things, whether these are extant organisms or extinct organisms, which is very exciting. So we can take these big laser scanners or these big structured light scanners out to places, and we're able to convert them into models that we can manipulate on the computer in three dimensions, as well as turn them into physical models that we can use in education, which is something that I do a lot in my job, as well as for other things that we'll get into, I'm sure, later here in the show.
Right. And I think most folks will be familiar with the idea of 3D printing, and mm-hmm. that we can, from a computer file, from a three-dimensional computer file, we can then put that on a fancy machine that will create a three-dimensional, usually in plastic, I think mm-hmm. is what maybe most people are familiar with, as an end product, a three-dimensional sculpture of that thing that was on the computer screen. Is that basically it?
Yeah. It starts out with a file, whether that's something that we generate ourselves or someone has put online that people can access, right? You get this file and you can use it to make that physical model. So there's a lot of consumer grade products out there that, you know, the average consumer in their household or even in some of the middle schools and elementary schools around here have, where it's basically like a hot glue gun
right.
attached to a computer that goes around in very slow layers and builds up that physical model. There's other ways of printing this plastic. There's resin printing, which is using ultraviolet light that is very finely structured to create these layers. Other like heat temperature methods to print nylon and things like that. And you're right, it is mostly plastic. There's a few other materials that can be printed, and a lot of places are starting to expand what that means. There's ceramic printing, and you might have seen news about trying to print a house, but that's not so useful for printing a dinosaur. So we stick to the, the smaller scale plastic stuff here.
So let's go back to the very beginning before we even start the printing.
Sure.
And there's going to be some fossils. Mm-hmm. And bones, whether it's extinct or extant, as in gone and still living. What's the piece of equipment that you use to scan all of this? You know, within the zoo and working with animals, we've got portable x-ray machines mm-hmm. that, you know, they're not all that bulky or anything like that. We just carry around and we can take x-rays. Is the scanning equipment like that? How portable is this and what does that entail?
Yeah, some of it is very portable and allows us to scan very large things. We use a laser line probe as one of our primary scanning tools. It's a little bit longer than my arm. I'm a short guy. But it's, you know, it's maybe 6 feet long total with a couple knuckle joints in there for an elbow and a wrist type thing with a little laser gun essentially on the end. And you pass this laser across whatever the item is, whether that's a bone from a modern organism or whether that's a fossil. And the computer will take that positional data from sensors in the knuckles and the surface reflected data from that laser and compile it all together to create this mesh. And then if you do that a couple times while rotating the object, you can end up with multiple surfaces, and then the computer can stitch those together. The other way that we can do this is with photographs called photogrammetry, where computers can look at different images that you put into the system and says, oh, there's an overlap here and here. And because of the parallax effect, they can tell what sort of structure is underlying that. And that's super useful for using on very large surfaces. Like you can do this with a drone on a rock exposure to map an eighth of a mile long dinosaur trackway. So that's a lot of what I've done down in southeastern Utah with 3D stuff prior to coming to the museum up here. And we do some of that, not as much as the direct laser scanning. And we also do some handheld light scanning as well that can capture the color data. So that's the thing about the laser scanning, very, very, very detailed, but it doesn't capture what the physical surface looks like in terms of light. It only captures the underlying structure. So using something that captures the light data allows us to see discoloration, where things may have been painted on or things like this. It, depending on the use case that you want, if you want it to be printed, you don't care about the color. You're just going to print the underlying surface anyway. But if you're putting this in a digital museum, for example, if you want this to be displayed on a kiosk in your museum or on a website, you want to have often that color data so that visitors can get the experience of looking at the original object.
The technologies, right, have been coming along over the years. Mm-hmm. I could maybe say a quick story about the Idaho Virtualization Lab. It started back in 2004 with a man named Ralph Chapman, a paleontologist who came to the museum back around that time from the Smithsonian, and he was involved in the late 90s with the very first project in scanning a fossil, which turned out to be Triceratops. So when he came here with that knowledge, he was an early adopter of scanning. Way back into, you know, so we're 20 plus years ago doing that work, and he started the IVL at our museum. And so that's why we have the earliest and the best lab and experience at doing this kind of thing. And very early on, he figured out that using the laser methodology and using light-based would get you the best precision, which for our business is actually the most important thing. Mm-hmm. We want to replicate the real thing. I'll flip this around. So why do we want to do this? What's the value of scanning? Like if I've got the real bone, I've got a real skull of a dinosaur, why do I need a digital one, right?
That's a great question.
A lot of people asked him that question 20 years ago. So what's the answer?
For myself, in my current job task, right, as the director of the education program, I can't just bring a dinosaur skull out to a kid. If it's a original dinosaur skull, we probably don't have a ton of those just sitting around that we right. can hope is going to survive a classroom of kindergartners, right?
So Can I touch? You might even have some that want to lick it.
Definitely. Sticky fingers all over it, and you're left with bizarro fingerprints. Why is it purple now? We don't know. So having the ability to exactly replicate that surface is super important to allow me to do my job as an educator. So I can go out and bring this exact replica of an Idaho crocodile maxilla, so the upper jaw, or Idaho state dinosaur Erictodromius. I can bring out pieces of that to a classroom and we can paint it up so it looks exactly like the original fossil. So kids get that experience of interacting with the exact touch feel that they would get from holding on to the original object, but without any danger to the original object, right, which is super important. There's a lot of other reasons you might want to digitize a dinosaur skull, for example, going back to your question there. If you wanted to do some analysis on what this dinosaur could do, right? Could it bite my hand off? Could it barely gum a tree? You know, this sort of thing. You probably want to do some muscle reconstructions and figure out how strong its bite force was. There's a lot of research going on into what's called finite element analysis of dinosaur skulls to see how they were processing food. You can do that with a model that you make up, but that doesn't mean that that model is accurate. So by having a 3D scan of this fossil, that tells us actually where these muscles were originating and where they were inserting, how big these insertion and origin points were, so we can get a better estimate on those sort of things. We can also use them for other sort of geometric morphometric analyses to try to figure out how different organisms were similar in terms of function and form. We can talk about using them in exhibits, and we can go into that in a lot more, I know, with our current exhibit. And, you know, just in general, data security is important, you know, whether it's like conflicts that are happening. Museums have been lost during wars, both current and also like in the past. So we want to make sure that that's a way that things can remain safe, but also just in general, if we're putting something on display, there's a risk of, you know, damage, fire, loss, et cetera. And we try to keep things secure, but you can't account for every single thing. So by having a digital copy of this fossil, it ensures that even if a meteor were to strike Pocatello, these fossils are going to be accessible to future researchers in a way that the specimens in Berlin in 1940 were not available.
I was lucky enough that my oldest daughter, Lily, had the opportunity to work 2 summers at the lab. And her second year, she was allowed to scan and start putting together a fossil turtle. And it was actually really kind of amazing coming in and watching her do this. You've got all these little tiny pieces, and it wasn't a complete fossil.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that so important to be able to scan that and then try to build that fossil digitally? How do you fill in those gaps of that fossil?
Yeah, it's a great question. To go to the first part, we don't want to just be sticking things together all the time, not just because limited storage space. If we build a whole giant bone out, we have to find a cabinet that would fit it. But every time you put a bone together and you're rubbing those actual pieces of fossil together, you're generating gaps. Little pieces can be ground off. And if you're putting glue in there, that's a permanent or semi-permanent solution to trying to connect these things back together. So by being able to assemble these things digitally, it reduces the wear and tear on the original fossil, preserves that evidence, that data that exists in the fossil, while allowing us to reconstruct what the whole thing was. And you're right, there are gaps. Shockingly, fossils are not always perfect, complete things like in Jurassic Park. We have a lot of ways to fill that in. Some of it is by looking at mirrored elements. So if I have a left and a right arm, a left and a right leg, if I have a left femur that's missing the top and a right femur that is missing the bottom, but there's overlap, I can sort of stick those two together and mirror it back and forth and have a good idea what the original femur would look like. Most animals, vertebrates at least, are bilaterally symmetrical, so don't usually have to worry about one leg being beefier than the other. But for smaller things, smaller gaps, chips, cracks, etc., that may just be missing flakes of things, not a whole piece of the bone, we can also turn to sculpting. So Tim Gomes, our IVL lab manager, is an incredible digital artist. He comes out of the fine arts department here at ISU, and he is able to expertly fill in these gaps in a way that allows us to preserve the original texture. You can see, all right, he sculpted this here, so we're not trying to deceive anyone with the data that's there, but it also blends together in a way that looks naturalistic, like you would expect the original bone to look. That's the other way that we manage to do that. And we have a variety of programs for that. And we use ZBrush, which is a commercial program, but also Blender. We're using more now with our students because Blender is a freeware program. And it allows these students to come out with both the skill set to go into something that is commercial, right? With the ZBrush, there's a commercial demand for people that can use ZBrush. But there's also a lot of just general interest from students, and they don't have the money for a commercial license. So if we give them this free option as well, they're able to build up their 3D modeling, sculpting, assembling, animating talents without having to worry about losing access to that after they graduate here. And they can continue working on that as part of their portfolio as they go to look for jobs.
The industry has really grown in the last 20 years that I've observed it. And certainly in the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years, the efforts going into creating and making publicly available digital data sets of, we're talking anatomy here, so skeletons of modern animals as well as skeletons of fossil animals are becoming much more available. There's been a major National Science Foundation project to help boost that amount of free material, like these sort of, they're like digital zoos of skeletons, and our lab has been part of that project. Turning it around to education and research, how does this publicly available data actually translating into the classroom? How is it getting out there?
So I mentioned earlier that a lot of classrooms now have 3D printers because the commercial grade stuff has come down in price, where you can pick up a 3D printer for a couple $100s. And through efforts from the National Science Foundation, the work that the IVL has been involved in, these specimens are available for free download online. So teachers, whether it's in New York City or whether it's in rural Idaho, they can download a whale skull and print it out on their little printer. They can print out the whole thing over the course of several months, or they can print out a miniature. So it really allows teachers and educators in the classroom, even where I'm not at or where other informal museum-based educators are at, allows classroom educators to really take control of providing that direct hands-on experience to their students, where they can print out the fossils of Lucy, you know, one of the first hominids, right? They can see that and compare it to their own arms and legs and see how they are related to these things. So it's really great that there's more and more of this available, because the more that publicly funded, publicly available science is really, truly publicly available, I think it allows teachers to create these great lessons, but also shows the value of continuing to support these efforts. You know, we've got this great National Science Foundation project that you mentioned that's in the closing stages here, getting all that data publicly available. And it would be great if we had another funding push to be able to create more digital data. We're only scratching the surface of life, right? We can only do so much in our lifetimes, but there's a lot of data, fossil data out there, for example, coming back to paleontology, that hasn't been digitized, that could be digitized and made publicly available so that more people can be aware of just the depth and breadth of our shared natural history.
Where do you think this tech is going?
Some of the ways that we've been exploring here within the IMNH been an amazing project that's a collaboration with the ISU robotics department. It's called RoboDino. We are, in conjunction with them, building a robotic dinosaur skeleton, bipedal dinosaur skeleton from our state dinosaur, Oryctodromius, that is going to be able to move its head and tail around, but also eventually in the final form, walk bipedally, which is a major deal for bipedal robotics. There's a whole lot of work going in on this. This is really sort of the cutting edge of this. The first ever bipedal walking conference was held just, robotics conference was held just at the end of last year. It's a tough nut to crack, but now people are really starting to look at it from a human scale. But with a dinosaur, you've got a balancing tail that might perhaps make some of these issues easier to solve. So Dr. Tahir Demiad and Kyler Bingham, who's just a recently graduated grad student and got his master's, been leading the charge on that. And we at the museum have been providing sort of the skeletal data. I'm not an engineer. My dad is, but I'm not. But I am a paleontologist, and we do have this Oryctodromius skeleton. So by providing them that data, they're able to put that into their engineering CAD software and figure out, you know, all these important points that I couldn't do, but they know how to make these legs move with servos and actuators and pulleys and things like this. So we're going to have that up and running hopefully soon. We've got a paper submitted on that for a conference later this year. So that's pretty exciting. And then the other thing I think is just continuing to expand our digital outreach and what that looks like. For example, we've got all this great work that we've been doing scanning every single Cretaceous Idaho fossil that can be surface scanned. We haven't CT scanned most of that yet. That's a phase two sort of thing. But every single Cretaceous fossil from Idaho that has some sort of identifiable morphology on the surface, we have taken a laser to and scanned it. So we employed a student to do that. We got an awesome grant from the U.S. Forest Service, Caribou Targhee National Forest, because all of our Idaho Cretaceous fossils come from Forest Service land. And with all of that data, as we process that, we're going to be able to make this available online, just like a lot of the modern stuff from the NSF project. And we're going to be able to work on creating digital displays on our website so people can experience Idaho's Cretaceous record. A lot of people outside of Idaho don't know that Idaho has Cretaceous dinosaurs, let alone multiple Cretaceous dinosaurs. And, you know, really Cretaceous dinosaur or Idaho dinosaur research in general is sort of where Utah was in the 1890s, just touching the tip of the iceberg. Really every Idaho dinosaur has been described since the beginning of the 21st century. So this is really cutting edge stuff. And so by being able to expose more people to that, I think we're going to have an influx of people interested in doing research here, getting Idaho students interested in learning more about, you know, local Idaho history, and, you know, really just being able to provide this data in new ways. So I've got a CPI, a career path intern, that's been working for me. And then Tim Gomes, our lab manager, working for him as well, doing animations of Oryctodromius based on the skeleton to show how this animal would be able to dig its burrows. That's one of the fun facts about Idaho State dinosaurs. It was a digging dinosaur. It lived underground in a little family group. So being able to show actively how this animal was using its paws to sort of scrape and using its feet with its shovel-shaped claws to kick out. And we're blowing up some of these 3D scans to put in our exhibits. We have an Oryctodromius claw, which is usually about a toe, about the size of your finger. We've blown it up to be the size of an arm, so you can really see some of the shape on that. So really continuing to push the boundaries of what is possible. Really, imagination is the limit on what we can do with this digital data.
When you look at the Utah fossils, there's so much because it's easy. They're easy to get to, right?
that is sort of the counterpoint. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Right? with this digitization and in Idaho, they're hard to get to. We've got all kinds of things in the way, let alone, you know, the basalt and all that. Can this somehow help our research with our fossils found in Idaho? Is there a way to take advantage of this that can tell a more complete story that doesn't require us to break through rock that sometimes is nearly impossible to break through?
Yeah, I think that having all of these things scanned, even like the most seemingly unexciting piece of bone that we've scanned, I think that will help out folks. Obviously, not every chunk is going to be able to tell the same story, has the same scientific value, but showing that we've got dozens of these Oryctodromius fossils and having people be able to compare these Oryctodromius fossils to other digging dinosaurs that have been discovered in Utah, been discovered in Montana, Wyoming, etc., will allow us to better understand us being the scientific community, not just us here at ISU or at the IMNH, but us, the broader scientific community, understand how Idaho and our unique Cretaceous upland ecosystem ties into the broader picture of Cretaceous research. It was an interesting time when Idaho's Cretaceous rocks were being laid down, with flowering plants just barely starting to come on the scene and make a really big impact. A lot of charismatic dinosaur groups were just starting to emerge as major players on the world stage. So by putting even these small pieces that may not mean a whole lot to a person that's scanning it, but a researcher in London or Berlin or Beijing might see that and be like, oh, that looks just like this tyrannosauroid that I have, or this early bird that I have from my site. So really putting us out there. Pocatello is not the easiest spot to get to for global researchers, right? There's a couple flights you got to take to get here. This shows what is here. So if they want to make the flight, they can see lots of stuff and let them know what we've got on offer.
Okay, I got to get to the trivia question.
Sure.
I'm itching to know, actually. What is the coolest thing scanned at the Idaho Virtualization Lab from your perspective, Rob?
Just the other week, we have this great partnership with a lot of federal agencies, and including the National Park Service. Dinosaur National Monument brought over a bunch of fossils to scan for this digital data security, so that when these fossils are moved around, they've got a digital replica of these. And by far the coolest thing that I've ever got the privilege of scanning was the skull, the holotype skull of Allosaurus, Jim Madsen and I, which, for anyone that doesn't know, Allosaurus is sort of the apex predator of North American Jurassic ecosystems, 30 feet long, big beefy bodybuilder arms, forget T-Rex, right? This had beefy arms, three claws on its fingers, it had opposable thumbs. Its thumb claw would have been about 12 inches along the curve. It would have just grabbed and held as it attacked its prey, right? And the skull was beautiful,
right?
Absolutely beautiful. Just like the whole thing was there. You would think that this is an animal that recently died, except its bones were fossilized in this brown color, but everything was articulated and perfect.
I hear Rob describe this and I'm kind of going, this is like, you know, me or every kid when they're 5 or 6 years
right?
old and they see an Allosaur or a Tyrannosaurus Rex and they're like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. You know, so keep the passion. Don't ever lose that. So honestly, and we want to thank Rob for joining us today, and to learn more about our scanning here at the Virtualization Lab, please visit isu.edu/IMNH. Or better yet, schedule a tour with Rob and you can feel his passion, and it'll be a fantastic tour. So thank you again, Rob.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University, with editing and production by Jody Schwicht. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to NOID KISU@ISU.edu.